We today. This meeting of the House Special Committee on Fisheries will come to order at 10:03 on Thursday, February 8th. Members present are Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Chenault, Representative Eastman, and myself, Chair Stutes. We do have a quorum, but that won't be necessary because we're just going to have presentations today at any rate. Please, this is a reminder to make sure your cell phones are on silent. We are allowing the use of electronic devices, however, during this meeting. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Matt Greening, and he will take care of it. I'd like to thank Brian Glynn, the Fisheries Committee Secretary, and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO for technical teleconferencing support. Today, the Fisheries Committee will be hearing a presentation from the Department of Fish and Game on its involvement with the FERC process, DEC on its permitting process, and DOT regarding its permitting process. As with the previous meeting, our intent is to give the committee and the public an overall understanding of the current permitting process that takes place in anadromous fish habitat and rivers, lakes, and streams, those that have yet to be identified as anadromous habitat. Welcome, Representative. Oh, my God. Garen Tarr. Yes. Thank you.
I know you know.
I've got my mind going in about six directions. Excuse me for that.
Pardon me for being a little bit late here.
Yeah, I know it. There's not much of it to spread out. Again, I'm asking that committee members refrain from asking the presenters questions on how House Bill 199 would affect the current process or questions about its strengths or weaknesses. We will hold a robust testimony at a later date, but these presentations are meant to be informative about the current process. The administration has not taken a position on the bill, but they will be free to weigh in from a policy standpoint when we hold testimony. First, we have Joseph Klein online from the Department of Fish and Game, Division of Sport Fish, with assistance in the room from Megan Boss, Legislative Liaison for the Department. The Division of Sport Fish is the lead division for the Department of Fish and Game regarding the FERC process. Members, please feel free to ask questions as they arise, but just keep in mind we have three presentations today. So, Mr. Klein, if you would please identify your affiliation for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Okay, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Klein. I am the Aquatic Resource Supervisor for the Division of Sport Fish, Alaska Park Fish and Game.
Thank you, and proceed with your presentation.
Okay. So, I'm here to give an overview of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process. FERC is a that regulates non-federal hydro projects. It is composed of five commissioners appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And it's a law that's been in effect for a long time, and it's jurisdiction over non-federal hydropower projects.
Let me take one opportunity, if I could, and I'm sorry for interrupting you, to identify that we have Ron Benkart from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game online, as well as Joseph Wade Strickland from the Department of Environmental Conservation, and excuse me just one moment here, we have Joseph Klein from the Aquatic Resources Unit Supervisor from the Division of Sport Fish. Thank you. Please proceed, and I'm sorry for the interruption.
Okay. Well, FERC authorization is required for the four criteria. If it's located on a navigable water, the project is located on federal lands. If it uses surplus water from a federal dam, or if it falls under the Commerce Clause jurisdiction of Congress overseas. And I wanted to give a little overview on a couple on the types of hydroelectric projects we're generally speaking of in Alaska. The most common is called impoundment or reservoir storage projects. And two common ones shown here are Blue Lake near Sitka and Bradley River near Homer. Two other common types of hydroelectric projects are one is a run of river, and third category is a newer category, hydrokinetic projects, are still primarily in the research and development phase.
Do we have any hydrokinetic projects now, and where are they?
So, Madam Chair, so we do not have any licensed projects. We've had a few that were in what's called the pilot project phase, but we're now down to just one active, and that is located on the Quijack River. And they're still trying to develop technology, so they're not generating any electricity yet.
Thank you.
The Federal Power Act is the statute.
Are you on a speakerphone?
Yes, I am.
It's very difficult for us to hear you on the speakerphone, so I don't know if you can actually talk on a landline or if you can move the phone closer to you, but it's not a very good reception here.
Okay, Madam Chair, how's this? I'm on my headset.
A little bit better. Let's try that and give it a whirl.
Okay. The licensing process is designed to document the environmental, engineering, and economic characteristics of an applicant's project. The process involves studies and consultation with resource agencies and members of the public. And the documentation resulting from this process forms the basis for the FERC decision-making. There are three license processes that FERC uses. I won't go into them in detail, but just to indicate that the default is what's called the integrated licensing process. All three processes follow the have the general process shown below in the slide, where there's two main phases. There's a pre-filing phase, which consists of scoping, environmental studies are conducted, and there is consultation with the resource agencies and members of the public, which the pre-filing phase results in a license application. That is submitted to FERC, which begins the second phase, which is the post-filing phase. And during that phase, an environmental NEPA document is produced, and it results in an agency decision. Next slide. Some of the major sections of the Federal Power Act include the following. A licensee would seek a what's called preliminary permit, which allows them to study the project for 3 years with an option to extend to 5 years. And it's expected at the end of the period they would submit a license application to FERC. Section 40 requires FERC to consider power generation and environmental values on equal consideration. Also under Section 4E, the land manager has mandatory terms and conditions that can be issued. Section 10J is for the federal and state fish and wildlife agencies, and they are given due diligence for their recommended terms and conditions. Section 18 is mandatory fishway prescriptions that can be authorized by the Secretaries of Interior or Commerce. Lastly, if an applicant continues through the process and if approved, it would result in what's called a license order, which includes any terms and conditions. And it's the default is for 40 years for the license to be issued.
What's the time that it takes from the initial onset of applying for a FERC permit till you actually get it?
It varies. One of the largest factors in that is the ability to access and conduct studies. So FERC, on their website, will state that in general they strive to meet 5 years, within 5 years, to issue a license. In reality, in Alaska, this tends to be a little bit longer due to taking extra time to complete studies, and also sometimes engineering and geotechnical evaluations.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 7, these major sections of the FPA, are these listed in sequential order, or are these things that can be considered concurrently?
Through the chair, these are not listed in, they are sort of listed in sequential order, but the three sections are, I briefly described the major topics with them, but there's more detail in them in case-specific information, if that helps.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, and Madam Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm trying to sync up is on the prior slide on page 6, you have things listed sort of in the pre-filing and the post-filing phases, and then trying to sort of see how the items on page 7 match up with the phases listed on page 6.
Through the chair. So the items and the points I'm making on slide 7 relate to the towards the end of the process in the post-filing, and specifically prior to the NEPA document and the NEPA document itself. Prior to the NEPA document is when the FERC will request agencies to submit recommended and mandatory terms and conditions. They will then evaluate them within the NEPA document and decide whether to accept or not, or whether it's a mandatory condition, and the associated impacts of those recommendations or mandatory conditions. So in general, it does follow a sequential step. But again, this is a brief overview, and for example, Section 4E has a few other topics under it that relate to the overall licensing process.
Mm-hmm. But it
follow
sounds,
up.
Thank you, pardon me. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like when you have environmental document listed here, you're referring to the NEPA portion of it, and then, you know, that would be, you say the FERC information evaluated within NEPA, and then throughout that process, you know, then you would later get your agency decision license order.
Through the chair. That is correct. So the whole process builds towards a NEPA sort of document, similar to other regulatory processes. So the NEPA document is a recommendation by the FERC staff to the commissioners. The commissioners can decide to deviate from FERC staff recommendations within the NEPA document, but that is a rare occasion. But the FERC commissioners then make the final agency decision on whether to issue the license and what terms and conditions would be included.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Proceed.
Okay. On page 8, we just discussed the NEPA document, which is required of FERC to prepare, and it would go through and analyze these power developmental issues and environmental issues and in context of the license application. And it would also provide the FERC staff, as I said, recommendations on each aspect of the application and in the NEPA document. And lastly, next page, I wanted to comment on two other topics that may be seen within the FERC process. One is called exemptions. There are two exemptions allowed under FERC. They're titled small hydro projects, less than 10 megawatts, and what are called conduit exemptions. They have not been used very much in Alaska. Off the top of my head, I'm familiar with one small hydro exemption. It would be Tasleena, and I think there's a couple others. And conduit, same thing. There might be a couple, but there are exemptions allowed that would streamline the process if they meet the criteria, which are listed here. For small hydro, generally, it needs to be, it's typically an existing dam, or they're increasing capacity area at an existing project. Conduit exemption is, as it states, is sort of an existing pipeline. One that we are actually working through is Hidden Falls Hatchery, which has an existing pipeline for the hatchery, and they want to put a turbine within the pipeline that is being pursued under a conduit exemption. The second topic I just wanted to bring up is, which I already mentioned, is these hydrokinetic projects. They do have a slightly different and special licensing process to help initiate this experimental technology and try to give it a little bit of help anyway to test and get the licensing. And even nationwide, there are a few projects licensed, but it's proving a little more difficult, I think, than most folks envisioned. And in Alaska, as I mentioned, we did have quite a filing a few years ago, for potential projects. But as I indicated earlier, we are down to just one project pursuing a hydrokinetic project here in Alaska. A lot of potential, but trying to get it to work in a real-time environment is proving a bit challenging. And lastly, in summary, FERC has three programs that they use: licensing, license administration, and compliance, and dam safety to oversee and manage non-federal hydropower projects in consultation with licensee, resource agency, and other stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this committee for Mr. Klein? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just sort of broadly interested in your position, are there enough projects under consideration that this is what you do for the bulk of your time? So, for example, I'm thinking you show Bradley River Project, Blue Lake near Sitka, there's Terror Lake, I don't know if I'm missing other ones. I guess I just want to understand a little bit about, you know, sort of the big picture of, you know, how many projects are under consideration, or it sounds like it's so many years, at least 5 years, you know, in this work to getting up to, going through the process for approval. Can you give a little sense of that?
Through the chair. Yes. So we currently have 32 projects licensed through FERC, and we do have a handful going through the licensing process now. I do have a staff member under me who assists, who primarily tracks and monitors and participates in this process. So once a project gets a license, they can also, it can range from a 30 to a 50 year license, and oftentimes somewhere in that period they will do an amendment or two or three, where they may add another turbine, they may divert a stream or something into the project, into the reservoir. They may do other activities that require an amendment, and that is also takes, we have to review that. There may be studies associated with it depending on the scope of the activity. And the licensing itself can be very time-consuming, especially the recent one that most of us may be familiar with, the Susitna-Wantana Hydro Project. It's a very large project, had very many resources that it was considering, and that took a lot of our time and energy. Smaller projects don't take nearly that much, but they can if they have resource conflicts and or issues that need to be investigated and better understood. So it really depends, but there's always something going on, either through the licensing or possibly the amendments. And compliance itself, sometimes after a license is built, we have to continually work with the applicant on various terms and conditions to make sure they get, to help them get implemented in the most efficient and cost-effective manner, such as an example would be fish exclusion from a tail race. Tends to be an iterative process sometimes to get the best design working in that type of activity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, thank you kindly for your presentation. Up next, we will have Wade Strickland, Program Manager, Wastewater Discharge Authorization Program, Division of Water, with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and he will be here to present via the telephone on the DEC's permitting process. But we will take a brief at ease while Matt sets up his presentation. Back on record. Mr. Strickland.
Yes.
Welcome. If you would state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Wade Strickland. I'm the program manager for the Wastewater Discharge Authorization Program with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Can you all hear me okay?
We can hear you fabulously. Thank you.
Excellent. So I'm giving a talk on the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Permitting Program, and in particularly with a focus on the permitting to anadromous waters. So starting on slide 2, this slide just provides an overview of what the Division of Water, what the mission is and the activities that the division conducts in order to meet the mission. There's 5 bullets there. The one we'll be focusing on today is the regulation of wastewater discharges to waters, wetlands, and subsurface, but particularly waters. Next slide, please. So the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System legal framework comes from the Clean Water Act and its amendments. Similar to the Clean Air and the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act has an authorization process to it as well. Under Section 402 of the Clean Water Act, it provides that any discharge to a water of the U.S., which is basically most surface waters, is illegal without first obtaining an NPDES permit. The Clean Water Act was written such that it envisioned states administering the NPDES program upon submitting an application to the Environmental Protection Agency. Alaska is one of 46 states in the nation delegated to administer the program, and I believe as of July 1st of this year, Idaho will be number 47, and I think the only states left that do not have authorization are Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and New Mexico. Next slide, please. So the state received authority to administer the program back in October of 2008. The program is called the Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System Program, or APDS program. The state took over the program in phases, with the first phase beginning on October 31st, 2008, and the last phase for oil and gas transferred on October 31st, 2012. The statutory authority for the program is provided in Alaska Statute 4603, and the implementing regulations are provided in 18 AAC 83. Industries that are affected by this program are any industry that has a point source discharge to waters of the U.S. In Alaska, that usually means oil and gas, mining, both large mines and smaller placer mining operations, seafood processors, municipal wastewater treatment plants, as well as other miscellaneous industrial discharges. The pictures there are actually, the one on the right there is the discharge at Red Dog Mine, and the one on the left is a platform in Cook Inlet. So, next slide, please. So there are two different types of permits that we issue. We issue general permits, which provide coverage both statewide as well as sometimes more regionally focused, but it covers a category of dischargers that are similar. For example, seafood processing vessels, we have a couple of general permits for them. And then for larger or more unique facilities, we will issue individual permits. And individual permits follow more or less the process that's described on the slide. We'll receive a complete application for a permit from an individual facility. We'll review that application, including the proposed wastewater discharge and receiving water body characteristics. Very generally, we'll be looking for things to see if the wastewater is potentially toxic. And if so, does it require advanced treatment beyond minimum treatment requirements? Are there sensitive species in the water body that require special protection? And we always take a look for freshwater dischargers at the Fish and Game's anadromous waters catalog to determine if the water body is listed as anadromous. If the water body is listed as anadromous, we consult with Fish and Game to see if the particular reach of water has spawning occurring within that water body. Next slide, please.
On that point, it appears, or it sounds as if you would be allowed mixing zones in anadromous waters if a determination is made that segment of water is not a spawning segment. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct, and we will get into that a little bit on the next slide as well.
Thank you.
So, on slide six, through the determination with Fish and Game, if Fish and Game determines that a particular reach of a water body that's listed as anadromous doesn't indeed have spawning in that area, our water quality standards, which are promulgated in regulation, do not allow for us to authorize mixing zones in that area. Therefore, the discharger is not eligible for mixing per our standards. A mixing zone is defined in our water quality standards, and I've paraphrased and summarized a little bit there on the slide, but it's an area in the water body where wastewater is allowed to mix with the ambient water before meeting state water quality criteria. And so there's a graphic on the slide here that shows a wastewater depicts a wastewater discharge going into a lake. And basically, within those, the gray area and then the lighter blue area, state water quality criteria can be exceeded. However, at the boundary where it mixes with the ambient water body, all state water quality standards have to be met in the water body. But in areas where mixing zones are not authorized, a discharger has to meet state water quality criteria at the end of pipe without the benefit of mixing. Generally, this means numeric permit limits are much lower than what would be offered if a mixing zone was available for permitting.
Representative Tarr, you have a question?
Yes. I just wonder if you can talk a little bit, because this is such a controversial issue and one that some people, you know, have really questioned whether it's appropriate or not. And this standard, you know, was recently weakened. I want to say it was in 2013, because the cruise ship initiative that had previously passed had increased water quality standards and limited, if I'm remembering correctly, some of the ability to use mixing zones, but then that was all changed in a bill in 2013. Is that right?
Through the chair, I don't manage the cruise ship program. I do have an awareness of the issue, so we may need to follow up if I get this a little bit off. But our water quality standards did not change based on that initiative. The initiative said that cruise ships would not be allowed to have mixing zones for their dischargers, so they had to install what were called advanced wastewater treatment systems. There was a science panel that was put in place to evaluate the installation of those types of systems and how they performed. And based on the review of the performance data, it was determined that for many of the constituents, those advanced wastewater treatment systems were able to meet state water quality criteria. However, for some, they simply weren't able to treat to low enough levels to meet our water quality criteria. My understanding is that sort of evaluation and those results ended up kind of stemming the legislation that passed that allowed mixing zones for cruise ships for those particular parameters. But I guess the important part that I'm trying to make is that the water quality standards did not change because of that action.
Mm-hmm. And follow-up. So as a follow-up, could you please refresh and send some information on that? Because I'm not remembering, and I thought there were some changes for mixing zones from stationary sources as well, and I could be remembering that wrong. So I would appreciate if you could send an update on that, please.
Through the chair, absolutely. So there's a general permit that is administered through the Division of Water through a separate program, our cruise ship program, that authorize the mixing zones for both vessels underway as well as stationary vessels. And so it was through that permitting process that actually the mixing zones were authorized rather than through a change to water quality standards. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Yeah, and if you have any info to send along about that as a reminder, that would be I would appreciate that. Thank you.
And if you would just forward that on to my committee aide, Matt, we'll get it out to all committee members.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So moving to the next slide, slide 7. Once the division has prepared a permit document that's ready for public consumption, this slide outlines what our public process is. We actually prepare a preliminary draft permit document, which is shared, it's called the applicant review, but it is shared more broadly than the potential permittee, but it's shared with them for 10 days, and at the same time that we release it to the permittee, or the potential permittee at this point, we send the link for the document to all the state resource agencies, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and a couple others. So at that time, we'll get agency input as well as permitting input on our preliminary draft documents for a 10-day applicant review period. We'll get comments back from those individuals. We will make changes to the documents as appropriate, and then we will go out for a minimum 30-day public notice period for the draft permit. We have the ability, and we have exercised this option to extend that comment period if there's significant public interest, or, you know, if we release, for example, a seafood permit in the middle of processing season, we'll allow for, you know, we'll actually usually set it at 60 days to allow for extra time to review because we know everyone's busy at that time. We have the ability during the public notice period to have public meetings and hearings. A couple weeks ago, we had a number of hearings on the proposed downland permits out in Bethel and Antioch and Anchorage. After the public comment period, including any public hearings that we had closes, we prepare a response to comment document for all substantial comments, which documents our rationale for either taking action and making changes to the permits based on comments or explaining our rationale for not making changes to the permits based on the comments received. We then post that document along with proposed final permit and fact sheet documents online for another 5-day applicant and agency review period. And then upon closure of that, we will issue the document. A point that I wanted to make on the slide as well is throughout this process, we send out special notifications to potentially affected tribes and local governments in the area of where the wastewater discharge permit is being proposed. As well as even before we go to time day, we send an early notice to them, letting those folks know that we're working on it. Next slide, please. So this is just a graphic that we often take to different conferences to pass out to people that summarizes our permitting process and how individuals can get involved in the process. It all starts on the top bar with the development of a permit issuance plan. We develop a permit issuance plan annually for the next 2 calendar years. We actually just completed this effort a couple weeks ago for the 2018 and 2019 calendar years, which identifies at the time of the issuance of the permit issuance plan the priorities for the department for working on in the coming years. We send that out to all local governments and tribes statewide. We post it on our website, and that way individuals can take a look at that document to see if they would like to reach out to the department ahead of time and engage with us on the permit development process. From there, a permit writer is assigned. Potentially affected communities and tribes are identified and then contacted with our early notification letter. We do the process that I just described on the previous slide of the preliminary draft, the draft, and the proposed final. And then we issue the permit online. After we issue the permit, next slide, please, Alita. After we issue the permit, it's issued for a term not to exceed 5 years. That's both in federal and state statute. There is a 20-day informal administrative appeal period and a 30-day administrative appeal period where an entity that has standing can submit either a request to the division director within the first 20 days or the commissioner within the first 30 days post-issuance requesting reconsideration of the permit. After the 30-day period, any appeal must be lodged in Superior Court.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the initial part where you said someone, you know, could challenge it if the entity has standing, how is that defined? You know, do you have to be somebody who lives in the area, for example, or could you challenge something and say, you know, if you on the basis of potential impacts to anadromous habitat, anadromous fish habitat or something like that, and as an Alaskan resident, would you be considered someone who would have standing?
Through the chair, I'm not trying to be evasive here. That's probably more of a legal interpretation for attorneys. But I do know our 15 regulations talk about how you can have standing or how you establish standing through a permitting process. And one of the ways is that you're meaningfully involved throughout the permitting process. For example, if you're not involved throughout the permit development process at all those options or different milestones where we go out for notice, if you're not involved, especially at the public notice period, but then at the end, after we issue it, you come in and appeal our permit, I think there's a provision in our 15 regs that say you don't have standing because you weren't actively involved. You didn't give the department a chance to engage on this issue during the permit development process.
Follow up.
Yes. Could you please send the reference to the AAC reference for the regulations on that, please?
Through the chair, absolutely.
Thank you.
Making a note real quick. On slide 10 here, during the five-year permit time, or term, excuse me, we have a compliance program that will send inspectors out there and visit the sites to complete inspections to make sure that the permittees are complying with the terms of the permit. They do follow-up compliance letters, notices of violations, and things like that if there are deficiencies. Within our regulations, which are incorporated into our permits through our standard conditions, a permittee is also required to notify us within 24 hours of any non-compliance event that potentially threatens public health or the environment. And next slide. Are there any other questions that I can answer?
Are there any questions from this committee? Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Strickland, after the original permit is issued for the first 5 years, can you give us just a quick synopsis of what's required to continue on with that permit after the initial 5 years?
Through the chair, at approximately for individual permits at 4.5 years into the permit cycle, they have to submit an application to us for reissuance. The application requirements vary depending on the type of discharger. For example, if it's a municipal wastewater treatment plant versus a large mine, there are different forms and different federal and state requirements that they have to submit. But they all have to submit an application to us within 4.5 years into the permit cycle. We will review the application and make sure that it's administratively complete, and then we issue them an administrative extension letter saying that we've received your application and we will work on reissuing your permit. If we do not reissue their permit before the permit expires, their old permit continues in force and effect until such time that the agency is able to reissue the permit. For general permits, the general permit itself usually says within 90 days prior to the permit's expiration that you have to submit an application for reissuance. And at that point, any of the entities that are covered under that general permit have to submit that application. Same sort of process. We'll review it, make sure it's administratively complete, and then send them administrative extension letters.
Madam Chair, if I may, is it as extensive as the original permit, or do you take all the things into consideration that has happened in the previous 5 years having that permit?
Through the chair, the existing permit as it was originally issued continues into continues in force in effect. Once we through the reissuance process, that's where we take into consideration all the activities and occurrences that occurred during the previous 5 years in terms of reissuing their permit, if that makes sense.
I think the question was, is there an additional cost, or do the... Am I correct?
No, Madam Chair, I know there's an additional cost to the permit.
That's what I understood.
We're not doing it for free, I'm sure.
Well, no, I get that.
But, I would just... if nothing has changed in the permitting process and they are up to speed on the things that they were supposed to provide during that permit process, I was just curious as to how intensive it is compared to the original. Do we make them go back and do everything that they did in the original permit, or are they allowed to use those permit numbers to continue moving forward through the permitting process? We don't make them jump through the same hoops that we originally did unless there's changes that has happened in that first 5 years.
Through the chair, there is some ongoing monitoring that continues throughout the life of the facility just to make sure that the quality of the wastewater isn't changing over time. But if there were some initial requirements at the original permit issuance that they satisfied, we would not need to carry those forward. But I do need to be clear that there is some routine monitoring that carries forward from each permit cycle to ongoingly evaluate the effects of the wastewater discharge.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on page 4 of your presentation, you have the statutory and regulatory reference, so that is taken care of for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Strickland, I appreciate it. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Let's see. Mr. Klein, are you still online?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm still online.
I have a question for you. I don't recall, and maybe you said something and I missed it. Is there a public process involved in receiving or in the FERC process, FERC permitting process?
Madam Chair, yes, it is a very open and public process. All documentations are available on the FERC website. All meetings are open to the public, both during the pre-filing phase, the development of studies, study plans, review of study results, through the post-filing phase, the NEPA document, which is a public document that is the basis for the recommendations. So, yes, it's a very open process.
And public notice is given?
Yes, there is a public notice. And there's a distribution list that FERC maintains that you can get on, and they will send to all the folks on the distribution list, you know, notices of any meetings and documents. And well, I think it's just mainly the meetings.
Okay, and is there, is there a charge for fish habitat permits?
I do not know that. I'm sorry. We do consult with our fish habitat biologists on our study plans and such, but the permitting for other permits occur after the FERC process is completed and the NEPA document is completed. And so I do not know the answer to that, but I'd be happy to find out for you.
Okay, we have Ron Benkart online, and maybe he could help me out with that question. And thank you,
yes,
Mr. Klein.
Can you hear me?
Mr. Benkart, are you online?
Yes, can you hear me, Madam Chair?
I certainly can. Are there any charge? Is there a charge for fish habitat permits?
Madam Chair, there is no charge for the actual issuance of the fish habitat permit, but in a large project process like this, as I discussed on Tuesday, we do have we entered into an agreement, and this project was run through our Office of Project Management and Permitting. So associated with that process, RSAs or reimbursable services agreements are developed. So basically, we do charge our time to, in this particular case, AEA, for working on the project, but when it actually comes to issuing the permits themselves do not have a fee associated with them, but we are compensated for the work that we're doing in preparation of issuing those permits.
Thank you very much. Do you have a question, Representative Chenault?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chairman, is Mr. Klein still online?
Mr. Klein?
Yes, I'm still here.
Mr. Klein, in your presentation, you say that FERC authorization is required for non-federal hydropower projects. Are there any federal hydro projects in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, my knowledge is very limited, but I do believe there are a couple. One would be the Iklutna power plant. I'm not fully up to speed on that. I know there's a settlement agreement when it was after it was built and transferred. And other than that project, I'm just not aware.
And Madam Chairman, I guess my question would be is who has the authorization over those federal hydro projects if FERC is not the agency?
Through the chair. So the federal hydro projects are typically what you might think of in the western United States that were built by the Bureau of Reclamation or the Army Corps of Engineers, and those would be projects such as Glen Canyon, the very large, Grand Coulee, et cetera. And I don't know much more about them except they have to follow whatever federal laws that, they're come under.
I was just curious. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's just kind of interesting because when we talk about pipelines, for example, FERC regulation is related to whether it's, an export versus domestic use. But then for hydropower, it's almost, there's sort of no relationship, I guess, to that the way the jurisdiction is defined.
Through the chair, that's an interesting comment. I don't know. I don't deal with the gas pipelines and such. For the hydropower, it is related to, the major division is whether it's a federal or a non-federal project.
Mm-hmm. But these ones that we've talked about that you're regulating are all for in-state domestic use, right? So it's just an interesting sort of paradigm difference.
And I have one last question for Mr. Benkart before we move on to our last presentation. And that would be, could you give us a rough idea of how much it actually costs the Department of Fish and Game per application to apply to DNR for a water reservation to protect salmon?
Madam Chair, well, actually, Mr. Klein actually handles all of our water reservation stuff, too. We don't typically have an actual fish habitat permit associated with a water reservation. It's something that's negotiated, and Joe can probably clarify that a little bit better, but his shop also deals with environmental flow reservations for the department as well.
Okay. We'll pass the microphone over to Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, could you rephrase the question, please?
What would be the cost to the Department of Fish and Game, approximately, for a water reservation to protect salmon from DNR, a permit?
Madam Chair, I've never calculated exactly what the cost would be. It would vary, though. One of the major limitations for obtaining what are called reservations of water or water reservations is having the DNR requires 5 years of hydrologic data in order to adjudicate that application. So sometimes there is available data through the U.S. Geological Survey. And if that's the case, then it's the staff time to prepare the application, and then it would be filed with DNR. And then when it becomes eligible for adjudication, it would be the time spent working with DNR to adjudicate it, going out to public notice, and then assisting in the finding of fact, conclusion of law documents. So that would be a fairly straightforward if the data is available. If the data is not available, we have a small group of staff that go out in the field and collect hydrologic data. Again, 5 years is needed, so that would add to the cost greatly. Or we can try to obtain grants to pay for U.S. Geological Survey stream gauge, which, depending on the location in Alaska, can range anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000 a year for that stream gauge to operate. So the cost, as I said, can vary widely depending primarily whether there's data available to file for a reservation of water.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. No other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. And lastly, we have John Barnett, from the Environmental Program Manager from the South Coast Region for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, to present DOT projects that occur along rivers, lakes, and streams. But we will take a brief at ease while Matt sets up his presentation. Mr. Barnett, welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Barnett. I'm the South Coast Region Environmental Manager for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm going to be talking about the process the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities undertakes to basically do work in fish streams. As you are probably aware, our environmental process is complex and comprehensive, but today I will focus only on those projects within fish streams. We have a number of different types of projects that occur within fish streams in Alaska. We have new culverts, which would be associated with new roads. We have brand new roads, where those would be roads where there was no previous structure within the fish stream, so it would be brand new. Culverts, which are improvements, such as culverts that were installed many years ago that are producing adequate fish passage. We may upsize those culverts. A lot of times, as areas are developed, you get more impervious surface, so you get higher runoff, so the capacities aren't adequate, and you get higher stream flow velocities. It also impedes fish passage, especially for fry, so we have to upsize those pipes. And then we have routine maintenance on culverts. Routine maintenance comes from corrosion. It might be road failures. It could be where the pipe needs to be slightly lengthened, but those are essentially replacements in kind. In other words, they're replacements of what's already there. We also have bridges. New bridges occur on new roads. We have replacements of existing bridges. We're going through our entire bridge inventory right now and replacing many of our bridges within the state. And then we also have routine bridge maintenance, which might be riprap armoring around the abutments below the ordinary high water of a fish stream. It might be replacing piles or other sorts of activities that would occur within a fish stream. And also a very common type of activity within fish streams would be roadway embankment protection, and that's riprap armoring, large rocks placed along the roadway to protect the infrastructure from erosion, from either flood events or just natural storm activity. We also have occasional stream realignments. An example of that would be at an airport where we have to extend the runway. We may have to shift the fish stream around that extension. We also have stream realignments for some roads where our road needs to be widened to handle the capacity, and so we may have to take that stream and shift it over to a new channel. We also do considerable amount of mitigation, restoration, enhancement that may or may not be directly associated with the project. One of the things we do for our wetland impacts is we do watershed-based permittee responsible mitigation for our impacts to wetlands by improving fish habitat in drainages in major watersheds. The number of agencies.
Excuse me.
Could you just, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you just go back? You said you do watershed-based, when you were talking about the mitigation, you do watershed-based permittee paid mitigation something, if I'm getting everything, but I want to make sure I got it.
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr. Watershed-based permittee responsible mitigation is an allowable form of mitigation for impacts to wetlands and other waters of the U.S. through the 404 process that's administered by the Corps of Engineers. A lot of times we can't, you know, we have a road which widens into a wetland, and there's nothing to restore when we impact it and place fill within that wetland. So we have options such as paying funds into a mitigation bank, buying credits. We can also pay in-lieu fees, which is a preservation approach. Those funds are used to basically acquire high-value wetlands that can be protected over time. The other thing we can do is actual work with those funds to improve habitat. We've done that on a number of projects where the area had been logged, say 30 or 40 years ago. The riparian habitat has been basically decimated, and we'll go back in as mitigation and restore that habitat. Other things we've done, a good example would be in Hyder, where we had impacts to the Salmon River by placing roadway embankment into the river, and our mitigation for that was to fund a joint effort with Fish and Wildlife, Fish and Game, and the Forest Service to construct rearing ponds and spawning channels on the Marks Creek tributary to Fish Creek, which is a large tributary to Salmon River. And that's what we mean by watershed-based, because it's in the same watershed or an adjacent watershed.
Mm-hmm. And one
follow-up.
Just last one. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And so is the state sponsoring a mitigation bank now, or is that a relationship with the feds in terms of if you you said you might pay funds into a mitigation bank?
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, no, we do not have a mitigation bank. There are, Sea Alaska has a mitigation bank, and there's the Southeast Alaska Conservation Fund that is a mitigation bank, and then the Southeast Alaska Land Trust is an in-lieu fee land trust for preservation funds. The state does not have a mitigation bank. It has to be a nonprofit entity, and we've looked into this, but their rules are somewhat challenging for a state agency to become its own mitigation bank.
And along those lines, how often does mitigation occur on site as opposed to in another area when mitigation is required?
Madam Chair, we are not capable of doing mitigation on site on probably the majority of our projects because we have to go up channel, upstream or downstream from the site. If we're placing a culvert in a roadway, it's hard to mitigate for that if it's covered by road. We can't restore the habitat, the riparian habitat, on the riprap embankment itself. And so we tend to try to move close to as possible, but not directly on the site. When we have a realignment of a stream, such as at Hoona Airport is a good example. We are realigned Coho Creek for about a quarter mile, and our mitigation there was actually the creek itself. We added sinuosity, we added large woody debris, we created riparian habitat, so we created a new stream reach. So in that case, it's about as close as we can get because the runway was sitting directly on the area that had been impacted.
And in relation to the culverts that you mentioned, how often is there maintenance that takes place on those culverts? I know from the last 18 months in different meetings I've gone to with the different organization, that seems to be one of the main things that they bring up, that if we replaced culverts, we would have much greater fish passage, that so many of the culverts are just simply too small for what's required. So do you have a maintenance program or replacement program or something going to facilitate that particular issue? Because That's been a huge issue from people that I've heard in the industry.
Yes, Madam Chair. We do have a program to upsize culverts, or basically to replace culverts that are acting as an impediment to fish passage with new culverts that meet fish passage requirements. Though we have a lot of roads in Alaska that were constructed decades ago that we haven't quite got to. In our main corridors and their larger communities, we've done a pretty good job there. But we are required through an agreement we have, a memorandum of agreement that we have with Fish and Game, that when we are conducting a road project that is impacting a fish stream, we are required to improve fish passage if the fish passage is currently blocked or not, it's not performing adequately. So we do have an agreement to that effect.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested when you were describing the creation of new habitats, sinuosity, woody debris, all of that. Has there been research or data that speaks to the kind of biological productivity of created habitat, if you will, artificial habitat, not to demean what's happening versus natural occurring habitat? Is it about the same? Is artificially created habitat more productive, less productive?
Through the chair. Representative, there's considerable volumes of published material out there. What we have is a monitoring program. When we create new habitats, such as what I mentioned at the Huna Airport, we have a monitoring program, and that monitoring program goes on for 5 to 10 years after that project is complete. And that monitoring program monitors the success or failure, or basically identifies any deficiencies that might be occurring, whether or not it doesn't have the productivity it had originally or not. That's identified during the monitoring process. And the monitoring programs have an adaptive management plan. If it's not working as we said it would, or as we hoped it would, we go back in and we fix it. And that is also part of typically part of our core permit process, is an adaptive management plan along with site protection instruments and monitoring. And we have monitoring programs that extend as long as 10 years plus. So hope that answers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up question. So I'm interested, both with the monitoring that you mentioned, if there's baseline data before the project happens that you can compare against what happens after the project, after you create this new habitat. And I'm also interested if you could summarize the vast volumes of data that you mentioned in terms of what is the scientific consensus. Is artificially created habitat, does it have the potential to be as or even more productive than naturally occurring habitat? So I guess two questions in there.
To the chair, Representative. To the volumes of data, I mean, highway departments throughout the country have had to deal with relocation of streams for airport expansions, roadway widening to handle the congestion and the traffic in different areas. And the various state agencies, as well as the federal agencies, Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries Service, and State Fish and Games, have establish some basic parameters and criteria for how to restore that habitat. The kinds of things that are done are large woody debris is placed into there. It's anchored into place. We replant the banks. We try not to create any sort of hydraulic jumps that might impair the migration of fry or adult fish through the area. What was the original question that you'd ask on that?
Representative
Chris Tompkins.
I guess I asked two questions, so I'll just simplify it and focus on one. Is there scientific consensus that artificially created habitat that is done for mitigation measures or whatever is equally biologically productive as naturally occurring habitat? Or is it more so or less so? What's where does the scientific consensus home in on?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, in many cases it is better because there were impediments that we've removed. So we can say that some of our mitigation, such as improving the the culvert size, you know, and also adding the woody debris. Well, a good example to that would be that same stream I mentioned before at Hoona Airport. It had been relocated back when the runway was first constructed, but it was just a straight shot creek, and we went in and added sinuosity to it, added more, you might say, hidey holes for the fish and protection for the fish, as well as some significantly larger woody debris than what existed there before. And our monitoring has shown that it has improved. The situation has improved in there. Biomass has increased. The amount of, and volume of fish that are being counted through that area has increased. So yes, we can say that it does improve in many cases, and in most cases it at least stays, comes back to what it was before we were there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr, did you have a question?
I did want to ask if there's a list of all of the, you know, you said as you do road projects that you're trying to replace the culverts that are older, outdated. I'm imagining that's just as funding is available and, you know, when the project happens. I'm just wondering if you have a list of sort of the ones that need most attention, or if you think that the way you're able to accomplish that now as funding is available when the project happens is going to work out in a timely enough fashion. Does that make sense? You know, are there ones that we need to look at more immediately?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we have a list of specific structures that is prioritized by Fish and Game and other agencies such as Fish and Wildlife, and what they do is they provide that information to us, and it's typically when you get funding to work on this project, could you take a close look at this structure and replace it if necessary? So it's a collaborative effort between DOT and the federal and state agencies, but you hit the nail on the head with the funding. We only have so many dollars to spend, and as a project rises up through the STIP and gets prioritized and gets handed to the regions to work on, that's one of the first things we look at. We have, and I'll kind of cover that process here very shortly.
Okay.
So.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
We have a very large agency involvement with our process. We work with the Fish and Game, Department of Natural Resources, Environmental Conservation for Impaired Water Bodies, and of course with the APDES program. Our involvement with APDES is predominantly the construction general permits, so there are temporary impacts. But we do get permits through DEC for that. We work with the Environmental Protection Agency on large projects. Fish and Wildlife Service on almost every project without exception. NOAA Fisheries, the Protected Resources Division, and the Habitat Conservation Division. We work with the Habitat Conservation Division on any anadromous stream under as a requirement of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. With the Protected Resources Division and in Maryland, we work with them when we're dealing with work in intertidal areas and we have to work around endangered species and marine mammals. We work with the Army Corps of Engineers on every project that has a fish stream and every project that has waters of the U.S., including wetlands and non-fish streams. We work with the FEMA Flood Map Service when we're working with bridges and working especially in the delta areas of streams. We work with state land managers, DNR. Work with the Office of History and Archaeology because they're the land managers on many state parks, state historic parks. And, of course, we work with the federal land managers, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, BLM, National Park Service. The existing laws, regulations, and agreements that we have to deal with, now this is focused only on fish streams. We have about 200 we have to comply with for all of our projects. But obviously the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, Magnuson-Stevens Act. We've also got a number of executive orders that we have to comply with. So agreements specific to fish streams. We have three agreements with Fish and Game. One of them is an MOA for design, permitting, and construction of culverts for fish passage. We also have an MOA for implementing safe passage of anadromous and resident fish while maintaining state transportation infrastructure. This is a very detailed MOA that sets the standards for the fish pipes that we install. Their gradient thresholds, how they are designed, what level of effort needs to go into that. We also have an MOU with DNR and Fish and Game regarding reviews of land and water use activities for our projects. Now, for projects that impact streams and marine intertidal or estuaries, also have to comply with the Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Marine Protection Research Sanctuaries Act, and ANILCA. Especially for our projects out in the Aleutians, the Alaska Maritime Refuge basically surrounds all of our communities up there, so we have to work directly within the requirements of that. In those marine and intertidal areas, if we have a bridge that's crossing the mouth of a stream that's basically under jurisdiction of both the Department of Fish and Game as well as the National Marine Fisheries Service, and piles are being installed, we then may have to go for an incidental harassment authorization from the National Marine Fisheries Service, which takes 6 months to a year and a half to obtain. And I should point out that those also involve notification in the Federal Register. So when we have those projects, yeah, it becomes challenging sometimes to work. I think we end up working with almost every federal agency there is when we're in the intertidal zones.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I was curious on that last point about working with NIMS. Could you give an example or two of some intertidal projects that have required that permit and that 6 to 18 month turnaround? Are we talking ferry terminals, ports and harbor projects?
Through the chair, Representative, exactly that. We administer South Coast Region, constructs and maintains all of the ferry facilities for the state of Alaska. And so we have a lot of ferry facilities that we work with, and all of those we have to go through NIMS, through the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and that's coincident with the Endangered Species Act, and those permits do take. The last permit we just received was from Sand Point out in the Aleutians out in the Alaska Peninsula. That took us a year and a half to get that permit. We have 9 of those permits in process right now.
It seems to me that one of those permits was overlooked in Kodiak and put the project off for, I think, in excess of a year, didn't it?
Madam Chair, you're correct. With Kodiak, we did an informal consultation, and then we ended up having a few more marine mammals show up than we expected. And so we had to go back and reinitiate consultation with the National Marine Fisheries Service for a formal consultation. Yes, a long delay.
Do you have a follow-up?
If possible, Madam Chair.
Okay, certainly. Go ahead.
I'm curious what the 9 projects you just mentioned are in process, and a couple of questions. What are the 9 projects in process? Are you working with NIMS in Alaska, or is this rise to NIMS in D.C. level? And does it matter where the project is, i.e. what marine mammals are around and whether those marine mammals are listed on the Endangered Species Act?
Through the chair, Representative, the projects that we have ongoing now, we have 6 in Tongass Narrows at Ketchikan, which are 4 of those were spinoffs from the Gravina Access EIS. Those are in Tongass Narrows. We also have Gustavus Ferry Terminal. We just finished the Haines Ferry Terminal. We have escapes my mind right now. I have to check with my staff, but we have 2 others that are also in process at this time. We work with both offices. We have to work with the Alaska Office of the National Marine Fisheries Service, their Habitat Conservation Division for their endangered species, and we have to work with Silver Springs, Maryland, with the Protected Resources Division. And sometimes those two separate divisions of the same agency don't quite agree, but we have to develop biological assessments, and then the agencies develop biological opinions based upon those biological assessments. So there's a long process. It would probably take a while to explain it all. But the endangered species we're dealing with are a certain distinct population segment of humpback whales, which are the Mexican distinct population segment, migrates into Alaska waters and has been identified as an endangered species that we have to address under the ESA process. And of course, the Marine Mammal Protection Act covers all marine mammals. So even though Steller sea lions are the eastern population is off, the western population is still on the list. So we deal with a lot of marine mammals. So,
I notice here, and I have you, Representative Eastman, I notice here that you say you have MOAs and MOUs with the different departments, with the Department of Fish and Game. Do those really have any teeth in them?
Madam Chair, yes, they do. If we don't comply with those MOAs, we don't get a permit.
And so that's kind of the authority that the Department of Fish and Game has over you is it's our way or the highway, essentially.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't phrase it quite like that because we don't ever get into that situation. We work very closely, and I'll explain that here in just a second. But
I'm
we do
delighted
work very
to
closely.
Hear that because yeah. I know of a lot of relationships where that isn't the case with MOUs. So I'm really delighted to hear that there is that working respect for each other. Representative Eastman, you had a question?
Thank you. And through the chair, can we go back to that last slide for a moment? So I understand that there are, obviously the department works very diligently to maintain those MOAs to make sure that for example, these projects aren't negatively affecting, you know, salmon habitat. But can you speak to the fact that obviously things don't always go as planned? Have there been failures in the past where one of these types of projects has inadvertently otherwise resulted in destruction of salmon habitat? When would the last example of that be?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. We've had projects that are less successful than we had hoped, yes, but we don't walk away. A good example, very recent example, was 2 years ago. We added the multi-use path here in Juneau out past Auk Lake. We constructed a littoral bench, or what's known as a habitat bench, on the shores of Auk Lake because our road was expanded to allow, our road embankment was expanded to allow for the multi-use path. So the fill went onto a habitat bench that was provided overwintering rearing habitat for sockeye fry. We installed that that bench. We tried to recreate that bench. It did not perform as expected. It was probably about 70% of it was successful. 30% is not functioning correctly. We have an adaptive management plan for all of those types of projects. What we did was we just recently hired a team of consultants to go in and develop a new program for how to restore that bench, and we're going to go back in this summer and reconstruct it. So yes, we have had that happen. We're relatively proficient at fish pipes and that sort of thing, but habitat benches, we've not really, that was the first one we've ever done. So it was a valiant attempt, but it wasn't as successful as we'd hoped. But we made a commitment. We always make those commitments to go back in and make sure it's correct because we have a mitigation requirement in our core permits. When those permits are issued, we have a requirement to undertake certain levels of mitigation, and that was mitigation for that path. Our permit would be out of compliance if we'd not gone back in and basically tried to make it work. So much like the Title 16s, we don't get one if we don't comply. They'll take it back with the Corps if we don't comply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our relationship with Fish and Game runs deep. We have a number of reimbursable services agreements. We provide funding to Fish and Game staff to go in the field, to look at our projects, to provide input to us during the design process, during the construction process, and during the monitoring process. South Coast region are the top four listed here are all part of South Coast region's agreements with Fish and Game. The last one is that Huna Airport that I mentioned earlier. We have a long-term monitoring plan, and we fund Fish and Game to go out and do the monitoring to ensure that the stream was relocated and meets performance standards. We have also reimbursable service agreements with Fairbanks, Anchorage, Soldotna, Palmer, and Anchorage. These are agreements we renew every year. We add special RSAs for certain projects. our permits and fish streams, Title 16 permits, as you're aware, for activities below ordinary high water. Once we have obtained that permit, we go in, we remove the old permit, or remove the old culvert, do the work that we needed to do, put in a new culvert, restore the situation, restore the habitat, to the, and then that permit is done. We would, if we went back in 10 years later, we would have to get a new permit for that same facility. They're only for those activities. 404 permit is a permit for the structure we're putting in there. We get a permit from the Corps for embankment armoring, for culverts, bridge piers, abutments. That permit is for the life of the project, and we are required by those permits to maintain those facilities. Then we have essential fish habitat assessment concurrence for any anadromous stream, where we have to obtain concurrence from National Marine Fisheries, and we get that prior to even applying for our Title 16 permit.
Is there, and you may have mentioned this, and I may have missed it, is there a public process involved in obtaining these permits?
Yes.
Any of them, or all of them, or half of them, or?
Madam Chair, I have a slide for that.
Oh, beautiful.
If I can get to that, I don't want to
okay.
take up all of your time. Really, I'll go through this very quickly. NEPA governs almost all of our projects. National Environmental Policy Act requires federal agencies, and DOT is acting as federal highways, and we're acting on behalf of FAA. So all of our most of our projects, which are federal, have to comply with NEPA, which has a very major public involvement process required. I'll quickly touch on NEPA. NEPA is not a permit, it's an umbrella law. So all of those laws and regulations that are out there that I mentioned in a previous slide dealing with fish streams, we're required to comply with those, and applies to all federal projects with Federal Highways, FAA, and FTA. If we fail to comply with NEPA, we lose federal funding for that project. That's called non-participation by the federal agency, so we must comply with NEPA. But NEPA also applies to state-funded projects if we need a Corps permit or if we need an Eagle disturbance permit. We have to comply with NEPA, and what we typically do is to expedite the process and permitting, we provide that information to the Corps so they can complete their NEPA process. Just wanted to touch on that. We have a current process that, in the interest of time, this is in your handouts, but it is a very intense process that involves collaboration and consultation very closely with Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and National Marine Fisheries Service. We also work with, of course, the larger agencies like EPA on the large projects. A lot of consultation. The larger the project, the longer time it takes. A lot of back and forth and consultation on how mitigation might occur, how it might be designed, how we can avoid, how we can minimize, and so forth. But we have a lot of different engineering studies and environmental effort that goes into this. Sometimes it's 2 and 3 years of field efforts for my environmental teams out in the field on some of these projects. But this is for your review. We also have the engineering process, which involves our regional hydraulic engineers. And our regional hydraulic engineers, the environmental staff, and Fish and Game, and Fish and Wildlife, and NEMFS all gather to develop a design that, in most cases, improves fish passage, at the very least, removes impediments to fish passage. This is all during the design process. And then once we've got our permits in hand, we're ready to construct, our hydraulic engineering staff and the environmental staff monitor the project during the construction to ensure compliance and to make sure that those pipes are performing adequately. Those RSAs we have in place are not only used for identifying fish streams, but also for monitoring during construction. And we fund Fish and Game staff to come to our projects. They have free rein to visit any of our projects at any time. I should back up. When we're beginning a design process, and doing the environmental efforts on projects, if Fish and Game staff are not available, each regional environmental manager, and there are three of us, we each have a staff of skilled biologists, archaeologists, botanists that are on our team. And we are also all authorized to trap fish by Fish and Game. So in the event that Fish and Game cannot get people to the field, we go out and do that work and provide that information back to them. And as a result, we have identified many fish streams that are now in the catalog over the past few years. So, I wanted to back up. You're back up on this thing. I got to figure out how to back it up. How do you back up the slide?
The arrow key up and down.
It doesn't have the little window on the bottom. Oh, yeah, arrows. All right, public involvement. Madam Chair, you would ask about public involvement. We do a public notice and request for comments at the start of our environmental scoping process. That's for 99% of our projects, larger projects that also might be have certain levels of controversy, or we're going to make major changes, such as going from a 48-inch culvert to a 120-inch culvert or something that will require a larger excavation. We would have probably public workshops. It all is dependent upon impacts. Public hearings can be requested at any time, but public informational meetings for larger projects are usually done after the design and environmental process and prior to construction. We may do those. Our public notice comment period is typically 30 days, but it can range from 14 days for routine maintenance type projects up to 45 to 60 days for EAs and EISs. And the larger the project, the more public workshops or public are opportunities for the public to participate. I think for Gravina we had something like 9 separate public meetings and hearings on that project. The Corps has a process. Once we've got the design completed and we've completed our environmental document, the permit application is submitted to the Corps, and the Corps puts out a public notice and a request for comments. And also interested parties can request a public hearing through the Corps process. Their public notice process is typically to 14 to 30 days. If we have a project that's in intertidal areas where we're driving piles and a incidental harassment authorization is required from NMFS, or a biological opinion and concurrence is required from the Habitat Conservation Division for Endangered Species, it is published in the Federal Register. And that is published in the Federal Register for, I believe, 45 days. Our public notice period, I think, is fairly robust. We sometimes have to make a judgment call as to whether or not to have a public workshop or a public meeting or even a public hearing if what we're doing is considered to be a routine maintenance replacement in kind. We usually just place an online public notice, but most of our logic projects have at least one major public meeting, and all the results of those comments that are received are summarized in our environmental documents. Mitigation. I touched on this earlier, but impacts on adverse waters routinely require mitigation to offset temporary or permanent loss of essential fish habitat. Obviously, the riparian cover, we have to remove the vegetation in order to do the work. We restore that to the extent practicable. Obviously, for riprap abutment underneath a bridge, it's very difficult to restore the habitat that might have been there. But in most of our cases, a bridge is already existing. In some cases, we are doing a new bridge, and so we propose usually a location as close as possible to the site of the project. So our mitigation typically includes riparian habitat restoration or enhancement at the project site. And then, as I mentioned, we routinely conduct mitigation away from the project site. I put 3 examples on here, but there's many, many more. Wrangell Airport mitigation. We had to relocate a stream at Wrangell Airport when we extended the runway. We really couldn't come up with a way to replace all of the loss habitat for that stream. What we did then is we went in and improved the Falls Creek and Anand Creek fish ladders, and we also purchased some mitigation credits, and we did a number of other things for mitigation, but we did try to spend a considerable effort on the Anand Creek and Falls Creek fish ladders. At Hyder, we did the Marks Creek rearing pond, spawning channels, Dyee Road, we had impacts to the Taya River with our armoring embankment. Also, our contractor had kind of gotten overzealous with some of his blasting, so we ended up with a little excess rock in the side channel of the Taya River. We mitigated for that by and completed a project at the request of Fish and Wildlife Service in the National Park, about 5 miles upriver on a tributary to the Taya River, where we actually had a pipe that had been put in by the Park Service that was not functioning. It was perched. The outlet was perched. Fish couldn't get back up it. We went back in, pulled that pipe, put in a larger pipe, installed it properly. Unfortunately, we didn't have much road, so we actually ended up having to raise the grade of the road in order to get adequate cover over the pipe. It was a good project. It's been performing flawlessly, and that was, again, another one of those mitigation projects that couldn't be done directly on site, but we did it nearby, as close as possible.
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
I was just going to say, this is a litany of a lot of places near and dear to me in terms of running or growing up fishing or other. Good to hear about DOT's productive engagement on preserving this habitat.
Thank you. Representative Tara.
Okay, three questions, but hopefully not too difficult in getting to them. One, on the public process, it sounded like, you know, you said, you know, maybe major projects, you would have a meeting, something like that. Are people in an affected area notified via something that's mailed to them? And that's just something, it frequently comes up with constituents, like wondering, you know, why didn't I hear about something? And I'm just wondering how you do the public notice in terms of, do you have a defined impact area where people might receive something at least in the mail?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we all of our projects have an online public notice in the state online system, but in communities that have a published media, such as a newspaper, Sitka, Ketchikan, you know, Anchorage, Fairbanks, we do public notices, mm-hmm. written public notices, and the larger the project, the larger the public notice. Sometimes we do large display ads showing the areas of where we're going to be impacting. Mm-hmm. We get the sometimes PSAs to go with our public meetings. When we do have a public meeting or workshop, we do try to get the word out through the other media besides just newspaper, and definitely more than just the online notice. In some projects, such as Brotherhood Bridge here in town, we did door-to-door advising people of what was going to be happening. Those were 48-inch diameter piles. And for those of you that were here when we were constructing Brotherhood Bridge, the sound of those piles could be heard up at the waterfall at Mendenhall. So we tried to advise everyone well in advance of what we were doing. And we had, I believe we had 4 or 5 different workshops regarding that. So we'll do localized mail-outs to people that would be directly impacted, as well as a broader approach through the existing media.
Okay. That's encouraging, because I think the mail, I'm just finding that it seems like if people get something in the mail, that's the way they're finding out about something. But, you know, so few people are buying the print newspaper anymore, and then they're selectively picking which thing they read electronically. So it just seems like that's been the most effective as far as these kind of projects in my area, is people, you know, physically getting something in the mail for feedback.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, we're noticing that, and we have that as a concern as well. But we have, for our larger projects, mm-hmm. we do have a website for all of our larger projects. We just posted this week, actually it was beginning of this week, entire state environmental document online. It's available for the public to see. So we try to make our documents available. We try to be as transparent as possible.
Well, in the last few years, there's been a map I could get in Anchorage, and I think you have all coordinated through, like, the local and state projects. I'm not sure if, I think it may be DOT producing it, but it's been great because it's been color-coded, and so we can see if it's an AWWU project, a DOT project, a local road, you know, project, and then there's actually a time, it says when the project's going to happen. So that's been super helpful.
Follow-up, Representative Tarr.
Okay, different topic. I'm just curious. It sounds like you have so much experience in these areas with how complex it is in terms of the number of different organizations that you have to work with. And, you know, I'm just wondering, at the department, you know, is everyone as experienced as you? Or, you know, do we have folks that we're bringing up that understand the complexities? Because I just know with sort of staffing cuts and stuff, recruitment and retention has been a problem. I guess what I'm trying to say delicately is I worry about when you retire and the kind of knowledge you might be taking with you. It's pretty clear you have extensive knowledge of this very complex network of agencies that need to work together to accomplish this.
Through the chair, Representative Tyree, yeah, I got my first Corps permit in 1978, so I've been around a while. We have a very, you might say, a very comprehensive training process within DOT for our environmental analysts. We have an environmental procedures manual that essentially provides a recipe for how to complete the environmental process, how to obtain those permits, and how to monitor our projects. It's very well defined. The environmental procedures manual is developed, modified, and updated by our statewide environmental office. Our statewide environmental manager, Ben White, is actually here. And then we also have a training program. We've just updated our training manual. We have a very long list of required training. We have three different classes of environmental analysts. We have ones, twos, and threes. And they cannot be the threes until they've actually gone through this process. But we do have a very, probably half of my staff right now are young and talented and very skilled analysts that are still going through training, but I have a lot of confidence in the future environmental staffing, I guess you might say, capabilities for DOT, at least in my region.
That's helpful. Thank you. And we've just been hearing, we've been in our budget conversations now, have started hearing a lot about recruitment and retention. And so, when you see how talented some people are, you really worry about, whether we're going to transition well when we lose that institutional knowledge and that you gain from, working through and really understanding how all these laws work together. And so that's encouraging for me to hear that you feel really comfortable about that. And if I could do one more.
One more, Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I appreciate that. One of the things, if we look at sort of how things were done before, for example, a lot of dams were put in. Now we know that was really bad. So, now the best practices is to go and remove them. In the work that you're doing, it sounded like upsizing culverts is kind of something that's now recognized as quote-unquote maybe best practices. I'm not sure if that would be the right way to term it. But, beyond that, are there other sort of things that we're doing differently now because of what we've learned in terms of their impacts to fish habitat and, working or not working?
Through the chair, Representative Tyree, actually fish passage is, in the past it was just throw a culvert in, let the water go through. We now, our hydraulic engineers, pay very close attention to the gradients, pay very close attention to the type of pipe that we're putting in, whether or not baffles will be needed to provide that those resting areas for returning fry. We also look at our depth of burial. All of our fish pipes have got a certain depth of burial, and then we put fish rock in that. We try to recreate the stream bed within that pipe. And in many cases, we've gone away from a pipe and gone to arches, bottomless arches or structural plate arches, where we maintain the natural stream bed and substrate below that pipe. And all we're doing is providing a cover to allow our road embankment. Or in the case of Angoon Airport, we cross a resident fish stream. It's not the runway crosses a small resident fish stream that's, I believe it's about 16 inches wide, but we're constructing a fairly large bottomless arch and constructing the entire runway and runway safety area above that arch to protect that. So we won't have any impacts to even that resident fish stream. It is more costly, but Federal Highways considers us stewards of the environment and what we do, so we certainly try to make things better when possible.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Interesting. Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate the presentation. Is there any other questions? We thank you for your time, Mr. Barnett, and I'd also like to say thank you again to Mr. Benkart, Mr. Klein, and Mr. Strickland for your time this morning at our Fisheries Committee. Let's see, our next Meeting of the House Fisheries will be on Tuesday, February 13th at 11 a.m. due to our subcommittee meeting. We will be hearing House Bill 272, Tangle Lake State Game Refuge, sponsored by Representative Josephson, and House Bill 149, Boards of Fisheries and Game Meetings, sponsored by Representative Chenault. So, seeing no other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at